From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I dig rock and roll music and I love to get the chance to play
and sing it.
Legendary record producer Phil Ramone has been charming hits out of pop music greats for almost half a century. From Peter, Paul, and Mary here in 1967 to Madonna to Rufus Wainwright in Carnegie Hall just last year, Phil Ramone has engineered and produced for the very biggest names in the music industry. Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Frank Sinatra, Streisand, Ray Charles, Bono. It's a platinum who's who of American popular music. This hour on Point, a conversation with Phil Ramone about making the best loved music of half a century. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine one hand, one mind, one ear behind so many pop hits, behind the soundtrack of American life? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Phil Ramone. He's the man behind many of the biggest popular artists of the 20th century. And today, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, Elton John, Rod Stewart, Ray Charles, Frank Sinatra, dozens more he's worked with. He's the recipient of 14 Grammy Awards, one of which honors him for a lifetime of technical contributions to the recording industry. He's also a classically trained Juilliard violinist. Producers don't get bigger than Phil Ramone. Now he's out with a new book, Making Records, The Scene Behind the Music. Phil Ramone, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom.
It's just fantastic to have you, and kind of unbelievable to look at this list. I mean, you must pinch yourself sometimes. It's, I mean, just on and on and on, the biggest hits, the biggest hit makers of so many decades. I mean, do you see your fingerprints on, you know, what Americans have been listening to? Are you the guy behind the soundtrack of our lives?
Well, you know, I'm very, very flattered and obviously honored that I've had the shot, the kind of thinking that goes on in the musical world. You just never know what's going to be a hit or what length or strength it has over the years. Fortunately for me, these artists are really the backbone of our musical world. And it's been a good ride so far. Still hacking at it.
I would say a pretty good ride indeed. How do you explain it, Phil? Why you? Why did people, these artists, they could reach out, presumably in most cases, to just about anybody they wanted? And I don't mean for you to just be patting yourself on the back, but just to analyze it. Why did they ask for, reach for Phil Ramone again and again?
I would have to give credit to two things. One is the songs, their songs. They're like precious children to me. And the other is that I've never stopped worrying and trying to make sounds better. It seems to me like I got started very young because I thought there was a better way for it to go. And I was mentored by many great people, including Tom Dowd.
You started off as a child prodigy, piano, but mainly violin in South Africa. What took, and then played for the Queen when you were 10 years old. What took you from there to the New York recording scene?
Well, I came into New York very young and had left South Africa mainly to study. And the world of classical music was extremely fascinating, but I was also really kind of cheered on by jazz. I loved listening to Charlie Parker, Count Basie. It put a kind of a wedge between some of the musicologists and some of the teachers. But because I was a kid and because they put me on television and, you know, you're standing out there with your short pants and
and your you violin.
Know, mm-hmm. And my violin, yes. Mm-hmm. I did have a shirt on. But, you know, I think the most important part of it was a guy named Bobby Bloom, who was a director in television and early TV, invited me in the control room. And that was such a revelation for me to go there and get invited down to Columbia Records and watch some of the classic sessions being done. I got the bug. A friend of mine had a studio, and I was playing club dates and opening for comedians and just being this novelty kind of act. The school and I didn't see eye to eye on that point of view, but we had no money, and it was a nice place for me to run and make a few bucks
What, Juilliard didn't want you moonlighting?
You know, yeah, exactly. At the time, classical people were considered, you know, you needed to be devoted to it. And I am, and still believe in it. However, I always felt that there was this other side to music. And, of course, you know, now we know in the newer world and the schools like Juilliard and, of course, Berkeley and many others have opened up the doors to the world that it grew into. And I think Andre Previn was a great role model for me because Andre had a jazz album and a classical album. And I said, that's it. Here we go.
And from there, right on into the very heights of pop. I mean, this funny tag that got put on you, ultimately the Pope of Pop. You know, there's so many great stories in this book, Phil, and I want to get you into them. I mean, one, this is pretty early on, even in your precocious career, where, of all places, you end up in Madison Square Garden with Marilyn Monroe when she's singing Happy Birthday in that famous scene to President John F. Kennedy, and ultimately in that sort of glittering dress and, like, over-the-top kind of presentation of it. You were mixed up with the Kennedys and their musical life. What led you to Madison Square Garden? How did you end up at Marilyn Monroe's side there?
Yeah, that's a nice sounding thing, isn't it?
Yes, Marilyn. It is.
It's very gracious time in my life. Richard Adler, a great producer, writer of Pajama Game and etc., invited me to work on a big tribute to JFK at the Armory in Washington, which was not an acoustical place you wanted it. It was good for horses, and I was a little bit young and crazy in the sense of what I thought, how to fix it up so it would look and sound incredible. And they gave me a budget, and we did it. And after that, Richard said, "We'd like to introduce you to the president," and I went to the White House. And we talked about events, and I asked why no one had been recording Casals and all these great artists
that JFK and Jackie were putting on in the White House.
Yeah, these were wonderful, wonderful concerts. So they arranged for me to start to do one or two of those, and in the same feeling that Richard had, he said, "We're doing the president's birthday. We need your help." And Madison Square Garden was the old one on 50th Street. It wasn't exactly what you would call a wonderful palace at all. Right. And very similar to the Armory. It was a challenge, and they let me have it. And I remember Marilyn Monroe walking in at 7 a.m. for rehearsal. And she knew a lot of the members of the orchestra because she had made an album about 2 years prior to that.
Yeah. There's an amazing moment here where I was surprised at what a personal interest the president, John F. Kennedy, took in all this music. There's a moment where he calls you at home, wakes you up. You hang up on the president of the United States.
Get out of here.
Happy JFK. But before you know it, there you are at Maryland's side. Phil Ramon, let's listen for just a second to bring it back to mind, and then you can tell us a bit more about it. But here is that Marilyn Monroe, 1962, Madison Square Garden. Phil Ramon adjusted the mics and more. Here she is singing to the president.
Mr. President, Marilyn Monroe.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Phil Ramone was right there. Phil,
I apologize for the quality. I think that's from an old 16-millimeter news guy that copped that.
Yeah. Well, no apologies required. I mean, it's a long time ago and a unique moment, all kinds of rumor around it. But just musically, what did you make of it? That night, were you just focused on, I suppose, how it sounded in the hall?
Well, obviously, that was the most important thing. And just a bit of trivia, Hank Jones, one of the great jazz pianists of all time, was standing in and actually played piano for Marilyn. on this beautiful 9-foot grand.
Yeah.
It's a trivia piece because I saw Hank when we did a song with Diana Krall, and I said, wow, do you remember that? And he said, yeah, I never got paid. So there's a lot of interesting stories around that and the party that followed with Peter Lawford and Jack Benny and George. Oh, my gosh.
And Marilyn so sharing her attentions with you for at least a second there, young engineer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was beyond. It was beyond me.
And, of course, 6 months later, she was gone.
Yeah. The tragedy with her. She was so sweet. And, you know, I love the way she played the character. She played the character called Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm.
Phil Ramone, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. Phil Ramone, super producer for, I mean, you name it, Burt Bacharach, Bono, Ray Charles, Chicago, Natalie Cole, Bob Dylan, Gloria Estefan, Renee Fleming, the list goes on and on. Listeners, you can join us. Can you believe there was one man behind so many super pop hits and stars? Did you grow up on the sound of Phil Ramone? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Last to know, my hands are shaking. Don't let my heart keep breaking, 'cause I need your love. I want your love. Say you're in love, and you'll be my God.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with legendary pop music producer Phil Ramone. Here's a bit of his work, Liza with a Z, Liza Minnelli, 1972.
It's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, 'cause Lisa with an S goes snods. It's Z instead of S, Lie instead of Lee. It's simple as can be, see Liza. I do it again. It's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, 'cause Lisa with an S goes snods. It's Z instead of S, Lie instead of Lee. It's simple as can be, see Liza.
Liza Minnelli having some fun. Phil Ramone behind so many artists. I mean, just touch anywhere. James Taylor, Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, Gladys Knight, Cheryl Crow, Chaka Khan, Queen Latifah, Katie Lang, Keith Urban, the Dixie Chicks, and a whole lot more. His new book is Making Records, The Scenes Behind the Music. You can join the conversation. Can you believe one man was engineering and producing all the way from Marilyn Monroe for JFK in 1962 to Rufus Wainwright last year? What's your question for the Pope of Pop? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Phil Ramone joins us from New York. Phil, I think you had some technical stuff going on with Liza right there. I mean, advancing things technically has always been a big part of what you've done, and I understand you were helping her kind of dance and sing and get a little lip-syncing in there at the same time to cover it. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Bob Fosse was a wonderful guy to work for and a great director. And he had staged this Liza with a Z where she had lots of dancing and lots of singing. He wasn't sure he wanted her to sing all the way because it would be so difficult. However, he didn't want to have her lip sync, so he said, solve it. And I came up with an idea where the voice was being tracked similarly to what you would do with film. Mm. It was a new kind of sync system, but what happened is that her mic was always live, but I could kill it, or depending on how out of breath she was, as she turned up stage, she really was in a pre-record moment. Nowadays, this is all quite common, but back then it was, you know, something difficult to do. And
yeah.
Fosse said to me, look, if the audience suspects that she's lip-syncing while she's hot dancing like that, right. I'm in trouble. He said, so are you.
So what do you do?
She and I worked out a signal system that I said, if you sit in the front row and you tell me when I'm doing it and when she's singing and when she isn't. And every time we did it, we fooled him because we changed places. We didn't always stop and sing at the same place. And then the little trick was that she would slam her chest where there was a microphone.
Right.
And it would nice explosion and sound in the house. And he said, I can't believe it. I don't know where you're doing this. And I said, that's the point.
Lots of artists called us.
Yeah,
I bet they did. A lot of people who wanted to dance and sing at the same time. I want to just roll through some music and stories here because I was just astonished at how widespread your fingerprints are. Here's a clip everybody knows, 1963, back in those early days.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she
Okay, girl from Ipanema, you didn't engineer it or produce it, but you're part of the reason we know it. What happened there, Phil Ramone?
Well, I did engineer it.
Oh, excuse me, of course, right.
Creed Taylor was the producer.
That's right.
And it was an evening, it was late, and Norman Gimbel came in with a lyric. Up until then, it had always been in Portuguese. Mm. And Creed, who's kind of an immediate guy, said, yeah, I'm dying to get this over to Sarah Vaughan. Maybe we could do this today. And everybody looked around, and Astrid said, okay, if you want, I'll sing it in English. Mm. And that's basically the demonstration you're hearing right there. Sarah Vaughan did
just
not
kind
decide.
Of running through it. Just kind of here's what it might sound like.
Yeah, it's a couple of takes, you know, and it's there to be heard. It certainly wasn't intended to stay in the album. Months later, I see Creed Taylor's put it as the B-side for the Stan Getz record, mm-hmm. which was at that time Blowing in the Wind. And some DJs across the country in the old days used to sometimes flip the record over so you could hear the B-side. And, of course, it took off. And the studio and yours truly became kind of popular with all of the Brazilian bossa nova kind of artists.
Did you know when this sort of just demonstration of what it might be was being recorded that, did you have an inkling that, you know, if the DJs flipped this over, this could be the hit, the big deal forever?
I don't think, to be honest with you, that I think in those terms. I was just so fascinated in working with Jobim and João Gilberto, listen to me try to pronounce these names, and of course Stan Getz.
Yeah.
It was such an atmospheric record, and I'd been experimenting with running a tape machine as a three-track with running it at 30 IPS, which in those days a lot of people wouldn't have wanted you to run it at that high speed because it cost money.
Mm-hmm.
But the niceness or the greatness of this particular thing for all of us was that they mastered it right from the three track. There was no mix. Mm.
We heard Dionne Warwick going out of the first segment there, and you were involved in so many of her big hits. Of course, that brings Burt Bacharach in the picture too. What was that relationship like?
It was the most incredibly warm, and still is to this day, between Burt and Dionne Warwick and Hal David. It set the pace for me. It's the first time I ever saw my name on a record as an engineer. The thing that really starts, and I think we talk about it in Making Records, the book,
mm-hmm.
the portion of where my mom, who turns out to be a good luck charm, who happened to have come by for one, she had left the store where she worked and came by for a minute, and Bert, being gracious, and Hal just said, sit down. And she sat down, and the record went to number one. I think it was Alfie.
Yeah.
And the second time, same thing. The record went to the top five. And the third time, my mom wasn't there. And Bert said, where is she? And I said, well, you know, it's my mother. You know, she doesn't come to my
sessions.
Can't
carry her with me all the time, right?
Yeah, right. And he said, I could she come down? Well, she had been knitting a scarf for him because
yeah.
he was always conscious of the air conditioning and running in and out. After a couple of albums, we got really close, and he understood that it was okay. He didn't have to keep running from the ice-cold control room to the warmer studio, which he right. and the Strings were happy with.
Right.
I still tease him to this day.
And all the hits out of that. I mean, What the World Needs Now, Love, Look of Love, Say a Little Prayer, I'll Never Fall in Love Again. I mean, just promises. That was a gusher.
Oh, it was a great many years together.
Yeah. 1972, another one of your big relationships, Paul Simon, Me and Julio here off the record in 1972. Let's listen.
pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what the mama saw. It was against the law.
Me and Julio, 1972, and it starts off with that very clacky sound of the pick on the guitar strings, and Phil, you had something to do with that.
Yeah, always have I think you learn from people like Paul Simon and others that sounds are things happening all the time, and so I've always recorded everything from the beginning, and the electric guitar was being played, I just mic'd the instrument. There is no sound that comes from it. But what you're hearing at the beginning, and it stays all the way through the record with Paul, is this other guitar. And instead of turning on the amp, we're just listening to it as a percussion instrument. And it's quite unique. Every once in a great while, I get reminded of what a cool sound that is.
Very cool. And I guess part of the engineer's job is to hear it and save it and keep it right there.
Yeah, I think the relationship for Paul and I has always been never to stop at being adventurous with anything. And I think that, for me, is probably the most exciting part about making music, is that it's always fresh, it's always new. Something happens that turns you on. It's just brilliant when it does it for you. Mm. And sometimes these things just show up and you say, ooh. I got to get that.
And you got a lot of them. Super producer Phil Ramone is with us. His new book is Making Records, The Scenes Behind the Music. Mr. Ramone, a lot of people would like to speak with you. Let me go to caller Nate from Andover, Massachusetts. Nate, you're on the air with Phil Ramone.
Hey, guys. Hi, how Nate. Are you today?
Pretty good.
Great.
Good. Hey, Phil. I'm in a band and do a lot of the producing and mixing myself, mainly in part just because we're unsigned. We don't have the luxury of affording a great producer like yourself. As I was mixing last night, my bandmate and I were wondering, you know, what would mainly be your focus to in a song? Would you focus on the groove and the tempo to begin with in basic tracks? Would you focus on, say, the vocal performance and lyrics? You know, what are sort of like the 1 and 1A things of importance you go for when you're working with, you know, with a song or musicians?
Well, you're fortunate enough to be in a band and have the writing and the singing all in one place. So I think one of the most important things is where the groove and the lyric and the music fall into place. So if it's being played by a guitar for the moment or whatever instrument, if it's written at the piano, design it around that. The groove is critical, but you also don't want to try to imitate something that just may be popular for this particular time. Design it from where the instinct was. What made you write it in that tempo? Now, you have to be objective. Somebody in the band might say, you know, or the drummer, this doesn't work here. Let's try this. It's all about experimentation, but if you've got the facility, like in today's world, you can record and keep recording until you get it right. But you'll know when it's honest. You may not all agree, but making a record for a band is quite different than making a solo record.
Phil, Nate's producing himself, has to, but you clearly were producing bands. I mean, did you have bands that would show up? Let's say Nate's band showed up. Might you find something, pull something out of them, give them a sound that they didn't hear in themselves when you first got together?
Yeah, that's pretty common. Only because it's hard to be objective and be the writer and be the producer and engineer of your work. That's the role that, for me, a producer really has to play. And introducing really good sounds is something that's kind of the basic. You have to do that. And if you get their confidence, it takes days, sometimes weeks, before you actually win the confidence of a group. Because there's a lot of players with a lot of feelings and opinions. It's very healthy if you can stop and compare yourself to what you think the song is. The song is the star, and then the egos fall in and try to play brilliantly.
Did you have situations where artists couldn't or didn't want to go? Were you were trying to nudge them, or is it your job to just win their confidence so they will?
I think it's a diplomatic job. It's not about conning anybody or lying or trying to put your own, I don't know, your own stamp on it or your own sound. It's their front cover, their picture, their sound, and whether it's as famous as Chicago or anyone else, it has to be designed around what they believe. Sometimes you just see something and you have to persevere and say, look, here's the way to really solve this problem is why don't we do your version and give me one shot at doing something I think might be totally different. And sometimes it's tempo. Sometimes it's a completely different drum feel or a bass line that, you know, becomes classic in its own sense.
Sometimes it's a song, as I understand the story. 1977, Billy Joel, you're producing his album The Stranger, and you suggested that maybe it could use another ballad. Got this on it.
I would not leave you in times of trouble. We never could have come this far. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, I'll take you just the way you are.
Just the way you are, Billy Joel, a Grammy for Song of the Year, 1978, and you asked him to put it on. Would it have just stayed in Billy Joel's, I don't know, spiral notebook otherwise?
I have a feeling it could have and probably would have. We got to know each other very well in a three-week period, and we were headed for the barn, so to speak. We needed to deliver the record, and I said, we're short a song, we need it. And he had played this for me from day one. He said, but it'll never make it to the album. It's just too, I don't know, it's too kind of syrupy, ballady. The changes that came about, the band almost laughed me out of the room, and I started messing with this drum beat, which is a half Bayonne and a half samba beat, which is totally opposite of where it had even thought to be. And Liberty, the drummer, had said, no, man, I'm not playing that kind of garbage. I'm sorry. That doesn't work. But when he got fascinated with how difficult it was to play this groove,
yeah,
he got into it. And Billy, I took him off the piano and put him on this Fender Rhodes with this kind of a spacey sound that you, at that time was called a stone phaser. And, you know, it spoke for itself. It just, he said, oh, man, does this make ballads cool? Thank goodness.
Plenty to talk about with Billy Joel, but when Bob Dylan came in the studio, very different scene. He just sat down, as you tell it, and played.
Well, Dylan was in a very strange place in his life. His romantic and personal life was in a mess. John Hammond, the great late great mentor to any of us, but particularly me, had called me and said Dylan would like to come back to Columbia Records. He'd been away for a couple of albums, and he said he wants to come back to the original Columbia Studios that he made some of his first records, which now A&R Recording that I was a part of took it over. And I'd met him, obviously, doing a couple of live albums. Then he came in, and his whole soul poured out in the first evening. Just probably the real Dylan of the person that I think he is. He's a brilliant writer, but amazing performer and capturing it. Things go right and things go wrong. I'm sort of well known for letting it all happen and making sure I'm covered with the right microphones wherever it is.
Phil Ramone, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. Go out with Dylan. We'll hear more when we come back. The new book is Making Records, Tangled Up in Blue from 1975, Blood on the Tracks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm and Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with legendary pop music producer Phil Ramone. He worked with artists, has worked with artists for decades, also worked with a lot of technology, got very digital right here with Billy Joel, She's Got Away, 1980.
She's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know that I can't live without her. She's got a way of pleasing. I don't know why it is, but there doesn't have to be a reason anyway.
He's been called the Pope of Pop, and when you see the list of artists he's worked with, it is not hard to figure out why. He's out with a new book that sort of tells you how it all happened, what goes on in the producer's realm. It's called Making Records, The Scenes Behind the Music. You can join our conversation with Phil Ramone. What do you hear in the Phil Ramone treatment, the producer's touch of Phil Ramone? And would the American pop sound of half a century have been different without this one man? Is it Phil Ramone's world and we all just hum along in it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Walt is calling from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Walt. You're on the air with Phil Ramone.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. I just want to tell you, Mr. Ramone, I enjoy all of your producing. It's been great over the years. I have noticed that most of the examples that y'all have played were analog recordings. My wife and I, under the name Sterling Fletcher, recorded a record in Nashville, and we looked for a producer who would do it analog because, to me, it is more pleasing to the ear. I know it is much quicker to mix with digital, but I believe it has a harsher sound. I just wanted to know what your particular idea is on that. Do you think analog is a dying ship that will never return?
No. I think it has a reason to be there. There are things that are a bit of a problem, like they're not making tape anymore, and there's just one company making it. You might be interested. This year, I made a record with Shelby Lynn, who totally believed that she wanted to make it analog because it felt better. And you're not for me, I like to paint both colors, so I sometimes record something analog and also into the digital realm. For me, it's how it feels and how it sounds. The mechanics of it are the same things that people say, well, I love the LP better than I do the CD, and I love tubes better than I do, you know, transistors. But it's all taste, and if you love the sound of it, do it.
What did you think about it when you first got into digital, Phil? You were never afraid of new technology. I mean, the She's Got Away we heard right there, one of the early digital recordings. Billy Joel's album, 52nd Street, sort of the first broad release CD ever pressed. So you were right out there on the edge with it. Did you like it, or was it a matter of convenience? I mean, you've got an ear, so you know the difference.
Well, I'd spent some time in Japan, and Norio Oga, who was the chairman of Sony, had played me some classical recordings, and it was just stunning, you know. And he armed me with a player and a CD, and I went home, and I begged him and the rest of Sony and Columbia Records if I could experiment with one record. It would be terrific, because it was definitely the coming of age of digital. There were many critics of it. There were lots of things that had gone wrong in transferring from analog to digital. Mm. Nowadays, it's so much better, getting better as we keep going, and we'll be saying goodbye to the CD shortly. Mm. But, you know, it's had a 25-year run.
What about that big arc, though, of technological progress from analog to digital and now to, you know, music files on the iPod? How do you assess what's going on with the recording quality in that evolution?
Well, fortunately, the recording quality doesn't change. It gets better. The fan hasn't yet, once they have gone through the MP3 and stuff, I believe manufacturers and people in our business need to play young people the sound of something that we get when we're in the studio. I always say to people, if you could just be there with me as I get to hear it in the control room, you would realize how much more is available to your for your joy and for your listening in a car. Elliot Shiner is a great designer. Put it in a car, and surround sound is all over the place with him.
But can you get that on an MP3? Will it come through?
Not really. Mm-hmm. No, not quite. It's getting there. There'll be new improvements this year. As you realize, the iPhone and everybody else is going to be, all these people are really going to be our communicator. Headphones are getting better. There is a chance in the home theaters or small spaces that young people have to occupy, or even many office people in their little booth, that we can come up with a more interesting sounding localized speaker, which reproduces the frequencies. That's part of the problem. And the other is the technology that how to play it back. It's great that you can store, you know, on an iPod an incredible amount of
thousands
records,
of tunes, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's some good and there's always some new. And I'm for new. I think we're in a great age for people need music. People love music. And it's part of the body. You would never have predicted that people would be running in the park with headphones on. And, right. You know, that was, what, the early 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And off it went. Phil, we have so many people who want to speak with you. Let me go to Joe in Havelock, North Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, I have a quick question for Mr. Ramone. I'm a big fan of your music you're producing. Mr. Ramone, you produced an album for Karen Carpenter in 1980. She was for A&M Records. A&M Records boss Herb Albert decided not to release the album. I mean, she had so many big hits. You had so many big hits. A&M Records had so many big hits, and then yet the album failed. I mean, you can hear it on the internet, and I think it's a good album. Could you just describe why it just didn't work out? And I'll listen to the answer up there. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. What happened there, Phil?
Well, Karen and I were really close friends, and Richard was having personal problems and took a year off, and everybody wanted me to make an album, and she did not want to make a Carpenter's record. She didn't want to compete with the Carpenters. She knew that she would come back and do that. She stepped out in a lot of areas. She loved Donna Summer. She loved the disco world. She loved a lot of those sounds. I think the controversy came once Richard came back and Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss decided it really wasn't the kind of classic album they thought we would make. It's sad because up until the day she passed, we talked around 10 or 11 the night before, and she said, you know, we've signed a new deal. We're so thrilled. We're going to make another Carpenter's record. And I still love this record. And it stayed on the shelf 16 years, and I talked to Richard one day, and he was getting pestered by people in England and Japan. There was a resurgence of the Carpenters. And he said, how do you feel about putting it out? I said, you know, for me, 16 years after the fact, there are things that feel very dated, but it is Karen, and it's the only voice of that type ever to have come around. I just felt it's okay if I get judged for being adventurous. She was like 29 years old or something and wanted to talk about subject matters that the Carpenters never touched.
Like what? So, what did she touch on in that unreleased album?
Things about love. You know, she was perceived as a girl that never went out and
right,
did
sweeter
things.
Than sweet, pure as the driven
yeah.
snow.
Mm-hmm. Goody shoes, you know, shoe goods, whatever. I used to tease her about it because eventually she introduced me to the guy that she was going to marry. And I flew home and called her, and she said, well, what'd you think? And I said, his hair is too perfect. It's kind of the way Karen loved things. It had to be perfect.
And you could hear it in the music, I guess, and you were right there. Let me get another call, if I may. Let's go to John in Nashville, Tennessee. John in Nashville, you're on the air with Phil Ramone.
I have a question about Simon and Garfunkel in particular, which was, you know, they were one guitar player and two singers. So when you were making those records, who decided to bring in Fred people like Larry Nechtel or Joe Osborne, people like that? How did you decide who was going to play drums, who's going to play keyboards, stuff like that, Joe Osborne, et cetera?
Phil?
Well, I joined them after they had broken up and then came together again in Central Park. Roy Halley had done all of those records with them. And there's a famous story about they had made one of the records, Sound of Silence or something, and their producer at that time at Columbia added drums. Very shocking, and everybody loved it. It became top, you know. Their life before I met them was wonderful. I got to see them in the studio a little bit. The complications that were funny were when Paul Simon now had a singles career and we were in Central Park and we went to rehearse and Artie said, no, I wish we could just do the concert the way we used to do them with mm-hmm. just guitar and the two voices. And here's Richard T. and Steve Gadd and wonderful players. It was very awkward because it was difficult for Artie to agree to this. But we had such an incredible rhythm section that we finally worked it out. But, you know, I think my intrusion was probably because of the records I'd made with Paul Simon, and we'd made There Goes Paul, Ryman Simon already. Mm-hmm. And we did a record, My Kind of Town. No, My Little Town, excuse mm-hmm. me. My Kind of Town was Frank Sinatra. Right.
Oh. Well,
sorry about that.
You know, who wouldn't?
Oh, well. But Frank didn't want to sing with Artie.
No, I guess not.
Paul wanted to write a song. It was this great friendship and of two guys who, when they wanted to do something, and Art let us do what we thought was the right arrangement. It was a Muscle Shoals rhythm track, and I think now that it's many, many years later, they can look back on the Simon & Garfunkel records, which as a team were probably the greatest records ever made. And then the stuff that we did together, which was just on occasion, but it turned out to be pretty good.
I'd say. Let me get another call, if I may, from Florence, South Carolina. Adam, you're on the air with Phil Ramone.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, fine.
Yeah. I was watching Saturday Night Live. I've watched it for years, and they had a skit where they were producing a song, and the producer said, well, I think we need more cowbell in this song. I don't know if either of you watch it.
Haven't seen it. Then what happened?
Funny skit. I just can't get it out of my mind. Every time I hear the song now, I just think about the cowbell and how funny it was.
And the producer that says, I'm the producer, and I say more cowbell, that?
Yeah, it was just hilarious, and like I say, every time I hear the song now, I can't think about it other than that cowbell being in there, and it's like you're listening for it even more now.
Phil Ramone, is that you? I'm the producer, and I say more cowbell.
No. Actually, I'm portrayed once by John Belushi, and it's like a recording, and we're trying to please everybody in the studio, and I'm twirling a ring. I used to have a moon ring, believe it or not, in the 70s.
All right.
And it was a moonstone. And, you know, I'm trying to please this artist, and she's like, she doesn't like the background singer's hair, so they cut it off. It's a kind of a Patty kind of Smithian record, you know, and it's just a wonderful takeoff. And every time I see the guy's name is Phil Malone. Mm. Close enough, right?
Yep.
That's me.
You know, so. I wonder, when you listen out over these decades you've been involved with so many, I mean, are we listening to your sense of how music ought to sound in the pop realm? Is it Phil Ramone's world somehow, having produced all those big, big, big pop stars?
I prefer not to believe that, but the most important thing for me is the sound of the artist and why and what goes into that. I treat everything individually. You know, it's
still, you've got your taste, your ear, your I mean, you know, do you think a century from now, musicologists, or 10 years, will be able to listen back and say, yep, I think that's a Phil Ramone-produced album. You can just hear it.
Well, that's very kind of you, Tom. I don't know. You know, I never stop to look back. I never look around. I'm really wide open to the what musical stimuli comes. It's all, for me, is about how the artist approaches their work. And if you can shape it and help put it into a place, I kind of think we're kind of movie directors. That's what we do. Some of us, I think, in the world of, that I live in, are very fortunate with acceptance. I don't know if they label me. I know that when I was growing up, there were certain producers who you could spot and say, that's, you know, Phil Spector, and that's it. That's the wall of sound.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's... I don't know. I wish I could answer that. I just think that, you know, what we're discussing here and what we discuss in the book is pretty much a lifetime of music. And that covers an incredible amount of change, you know, from the pop music of the late 50s and the Beatles come along. And then Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel and jazz. I mean, I'm so much attached to the freedom of how jazz is played and what goes on with it. And that kind of makes it new every day.
Here's another one behind us right here. I Remember You, Tony Bennett, 2004. Won a Grammy in 2005, and you, Phil Ramone, right in the middle of it. We're grateful to you for the stories, for the songs. It's all in a new book, Making Records, the scenes behind the music. Phil Ramone, thank you so much for being with us today. Really, really fun talking with you.
Thanks, Tom. It was my pleasure. Really is.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When my life is through, and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of them all, then I shall tell them.